made mama crazy cause we wouldn't wear dresses and bows. I played with boys, I liked tackle football. I shot snakes with my brother down at the fishing hole. I fantasized, I was evil Knievel. I built ramp jump garbage cans, broke my wristbone. Picked black bears in the summer, reaching right through snake spit. Mama said, girl, slow down, you're accident prone. The best part of those days is I was careful. Nobody telling me Mary act like a girl. When you're 10 years old, it's cute to be a tomboy. But in a couple of years, you gotta deal with the ways of the world.
Yes, when you're 10 years old, it's cute to be a tomboy. But in a couple of years, you have to deal with the ways of the world. So says Mary Gaucher, and that's the first track from her first album from 1997. And she's come a long way since then, and you'll hear about it in a special interview later in the show. And I do encourage you to stick around for that, because the way she talks about her songwriting is just fascinating. You're listening to Queer Voices on KPFT. And this segment is called Queer Music Heritage. I'm J.D. Doyle, and tonight I'm bringing you two very special interviews. In addition to one with Mary Gaucher, I've been able to track down an artist who in 1994 released an album I really love. And the name of the album and the artist is Jesse Hultberg. Jesse moved to Paris about 6 years ago and pretty much dropped out of the music scene, so those two factors definitely contributed to my difficulty in finding him. And when I started researching his career, I found that there was quite a story prior to the 1994 album. And it started back in 1982, when he was in a band called Three Teens Kill Four. I've seen that band described as sort of a post-punk band, whatever that means.
What was the first recording you participated in?
That was with Three Teens Kill Four.
Can you tell me about that?
There was a single at first, and there was a cover version of Tell Me Something Good, which was a Stevie Wonder song. Oh, no, it was a Rufus song, Chaka Khan, but Stevie Wonder wrote it. And we did a version that was kind of experimental with toys and recordings and people talking. And there was newscast of the assassination attempt of Ronald Reagan that we had floating in and out of the song.
You ain't in love like you should.
President Howard is an excellent.
But a guy will, sure enough do you
good.
Tell me something good. Tell me.
Tell me that you love me.
And then the flip side was a song called Visitation, which was a song I wrote with David Wojnarowicz, who was a painter. I don't know if you know who he is, but he died a few years ago, and he was quite well known before he died.
Yeah, I wanted to ask you about the band members.
The other band members were Julie Hare, Brian Butterick, who worked in New York at the Mud Club for years in the Pyramid, and Doug Bressler, who played clarinet.
Brian became Hattie Hathaway?
Yeah, Brian did a drag show called Hattie Hathaway and numerous others, for that matter, as well. Brian and I also, we accompanied John Kelly doing Joni Mitchell for years.
Oh, really?
Uh-huh. We were his first accompanist before he took that show to other places.
Before Zecca took over.
Right. Exactly. At Wigstock, we did it for years in different clubs.
How'd you get the name for that band?
Three Teens Kill Four, that comes from the New York Post. The actual title is Three Teens Kill Four, No Motive.
So it was a headline.
Mm-hmm. The first show that Three Teens did was, Brian, David, and I worked as busboys at a club called Danceteria, along with Keith Haring, for that matter. And the club lasted for about 8 or 9 months before it was closed down for not having a liquor license. And as a benefit for the, well, 20 of us were arrested, and we spent a night in jail, and we did a benefit, I don't know what for, just to glamorize our arrest, I suppose, in a club, and everybody who was involved with any sort of project, music project or anything, did a show together. And David, Brian, and I, along with, there was a poet named Max Blagg and a couple other people who worked at the club, decided to do a rock band, and we called it Three Teens Kill Four. That was the first show we did, and that was at a club called TR3 in Soho.
Are there any songs from the album besides Tell Me Something Good you'd like to mention?
From that first album, I like all the songs on that album. I think it's I'm very proud of that album. It was hard to make. We recorded in a studio in the Bronx, and it was like a 40-minute subway ride every time we went out to do this recording. And let me see, what other songs were there? There was a song called Hold Up, which was at the time, you know, rap music was big. We just sort of made fun of different things and did a sort of fake rap, white boy rap at the time. And I like the words in that song. Visitation didn't make it to the album, so it stayed on the single, and I always liked that song.
It must be very rare.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know where you'd find that recording. And
I have the album in front of me.
Ah, okay, there you go. Let me see. Well, can you tell me the name of the songs? Because I don't remember.
Hold Up, Tell Me Something Good.
Yeah.
5-4.
5-4, that's a great song, too. I like that song. It's just like one of those songs where it's just a bass line that starts things, and David was a poet, so he just sort of rambled on sometimes, or he took stuff from his writing, and it was always interesting. Sometimes dark, you know, pretty dark, but interesting.
And the other side was crime drama.
Crime drama was me and Julie mostly. That was Julie sings that, and I had a lot to do with the music.
And Hut Bean Song.
That was me and David too, and those are great songs. I love those songs. I haven't listened to them in so long. Bean Song is I think really funny. That's just one of those things where you're playing in the studio and you know somebody starts recounting cliches. You know, we must improve our bus. The bigger the better. The tighter the sweater. The boys depend on us. That was one of the lines.
And Hunger was the last track.
Yeah, that was kind of typical Three Teens Kill Four song. Angry.
Were all the band members gay?
Oh, no, Doug wasn't gay, Julie wasn't gay.
Okay.
No, just Brian, me, and David.
Y'all performed at Wigstock?
The first couple of years, yes. The first, I don't know, three or four years?
I saw three different mentions of you. You with the group, or are you by yourself at Wigstock? The group.
I always did both. I always did the first two or three years I performed with the band, but always did a drag thing too at Wigstock.
Yeah, I found mention of you doing a Melanie parody of Lay Down, Lay Down.
Yeah, that was fun. That was one of the first times I did drag. That was a lot of fun.
And doing Peter Paul and Big Mary, Poof the Magic Drag Queen.
Yeah, and that became more of a, I did that a few times, I think like three times. And that was actually, it was in the film too, but they had to cut it out because Peter, Paul, and Mary couldn't give the right to use it. They had sold it to Disney.
Oh.
And so after the film was edited, the producers, you know, tried to get them to, sign a release, and they couldn't. They had lost their legal right to the song.
I found references to you being in the movie Longtime Companion.
Mm-hmm.
Tell me about that.
At that time, I was doing a cabaret act with Melora Kreger, who later on became the rock band Rasputina, and Lee Kimball, who was another pyramid drag act. And the act was called the Finger Lakes Trio, and we used to do it in different clubs in New York City where we would dress up like provincial chamber music musicians, and we would, but instead of doing real chamber music, we would do disco 70s hits like Fly Robin Fly and what's the song I sing in the, it's YMCA in the film Long Time Companion. And whoever the director was, I think it's Norman Renee or something like that. Anyway, he saw us in a nightclub, and he was in the middle of filming the film Long Time Companion, and he needed something light and a little more comic at the end to because it's such a heavy film, it's very right. down. So at the end, he decided to have a scene in a nightclub, and he'd show us singing YMCA, and because it was a comic act, and he felt it had some sort of connection to the whole story of what was going on at the time with AIDS, and that's how it ended up being in the film.
And from the movie from 1990, Long Time Companion, here's that short scene with Jesse Holtberg singing with the Finger Lakes Trio. It takes place in a club, so you'll hear the customers enjoying the song.
Young man, there's no need to feel down. I said, young man, pick yourself off the ground. Young man, 'cause you're in a new town. There's no need to be unhappy. It's fun to stay at the YMCA. It's fun to stay at the YMCA. You can get yourself clean. You can have a good meal. You can do whatever you feel.
And that brings us up to the 1994 album that started my admiration for Jesse Holtberg's work. Its first track is the song My Friend Wants a Baby, and I asked him about that.
My Friend Wants a Baby was me talking about my sister, actually. And it's a song about the numerous women who I knew, but especially my sister who motivated me, who wanted to have kids, or wanted to have a child in this sort of desperate way, and it really for no other reason than to fulfill their own ego in a way. And the irony of that and the irony of gay men or lesbians not being able to adopt children, I felt was peculiar, because here there were people who wanted to have children for really good reasons, and that's what that's about. That's what that song is about.
My friend wants a baby, but I'm not so sure. She doesn't just need something for her validation in a crib without real love to give, or validation to a child. Every time I see her, I wanna say something, but you know it's not my place. And another thing, it's only been a couple of years since we've worked out our own tears, and frankly I don't wanna fight. Ooh, 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 ooh. Yeah, yeah. I don't know her husband all too well, but he seems like a nice guy. I think it's swell that they married up, settled down, smashed the cup, stopped fooling around. And I hope it lasts a million years. I don't see real comfort in this man's face, just a blind desire to add to the race, when there are already enough crawling around on this blue earth, children unwanted and alone. Yeah. In the morning sunlight, I look down at my friend's face, and I know he wants to adopt a child like nobody gets. But according to the law, he is not the right at all, because he shares his love with me. I don't know the logic behind this fear. All I know is that they're making armies out there. And we sit here and we stall. Fear of love permeates us all, being children unwanted and alone.
Tell me about Our Open Eyes.
That was a song in reaction to New York City and to living in a place that was too fast and inhuman. And it's a combination of different stories, because I when I was a teenager, I went to Provincetown with my best friend, and it was the first time that we had exposure to people being openly gay in the street. And we just sat down and watched it for so long. We didn't even move. You know, we just watched it amazed, and it was like very nice.
The first time Rachel and I went to Provincetown, we found ourselves a stupid. We sat down, and for 6 hours we watched the people go by,
walking by,
women with women, men with men, and our open eyes.
I love your version of If I Can't Have You.
Thank you.
How'd you decide to cover that song?
Well, that was born out of Finger Lakes Trio, because it was one of the disco hits we did, like a chamber music version of, when the group that performs in Longtime Companion. It was just one of the songs we did in our repertoire, and after every time we did it, people reacted very well to it, and I started to sing it seriously with a guitar, and just liked singing it, so that's the only reason. Just liked it.
Don't know why I'm surviving every lonely day, when there's got to be no chance for me. My life would end, and it doesn't matter how I cry. My tears of love were a waste of time. If I turn away, am I strong enough to see it through? Go crazy is what I will do. If I can't have you, I don't want nobody, baby. If I can't have you, oh, oh, oh. If I can't have you, I don't want nobody, baby. If I can't have you, oh, oh, oh. Can't let go, and it doesn't matter how I try. I gave it all so thoughtlessly to you, my love, to dreams that never will come true. Am I strong enough to see it through? Crazy is what I will do. If I can't have you, I don't want nobody, baby. If I can't have you, oh, oh, oh. If I can't have you, I don't want nobody, baby. If I can't have you, oh, oh, oh. If I can't have you,
was released as a CD single?
Oh, you know, when you do releases as an independent, you know, it doesn't really mean much of anything. I never released it commercially as a single. I never tried to sell to stores as a single, but it was given out to radio stations.
Right. It says for radio use only.
There you go. Well.
And there's the Priest song and Raquel Welch. Those three songs.
Oh, that's how it was.
Mm-hmm.
Yep, that sounds familiar.
And there's a guy on eBay selling these.
Oh, good for him.
He has.
I hope he's making a mint.
Well, he has a constant ad. It's like he has endless supply or something.
Of that single?
Yeah.
It's
always there. You go on eBay and search, and you'll find it.
Yes, it was a CD single, but never for sale.
Right. Yeah. It says not for sale.
Oh, it does too.
And it has the same picture as the album, only it's all red.
It's right, red. I don't remember how many copies you made, but I remember mailing them and putting them in envelopes and mailing them to radio stations.
My favorite song on the album is Constant Thing, I Was Raised a Straight Boy.
Really? That's interesting.
Tell me about that, please.
I used to sing that a cappella without any instrumentation on stage, and it's just one of those, you know, it's very anthemic. It's an anthem. But it's not a song that talks to me too much anymore. I mean, there's aspects of it that I like, and other ones that sort of make me feel, oh, you know, you're just sort of blowing your horn a little bit there. But there is one aspect of it that I like, which is that when people think of their homophobia or anti-gay behavior, they don't recognize the fact that the presumption of heterosexuality from when you're born is the base of your own homophobia and other people's, because you have to come to an understanding yourself later on without much help around you, and it's that presumption that I think is the cornerstone of what, you know, keeps things hard for us. So that's what I tried to make that song about.
I have seen it in my dreams night and day. The only constant thing in life is that there's change. While I grow the garbage, I hope slips away. I was raised a straight boy, but I'm not today. I was raised a straight boy, but I'm not today. I was taught that pink's for girls and blue is for boys. I was given guns to play with and army toys. And if these things took on a certain gender sway, I was raised a straight boy, but I'm not today. There are even words boys aren't supposed to say. Sit and stare, mimicking our parents from childhood days. Scared to make decisions in a brand new way. We were raised straight boys, but we're not today. Myself returning to my child. I know I'm just reacting and it's way too late. I'm always reacting and it's way too late.
Look, honey, there's Tom, that nice man from the PTA meetings. Tom, hello, Tom.
Why, so it is, dear.
Tom, Mary, you're looking wonderful. And I see there's a new addition to the family. Who is this little cutie?
This is Jesse. He's 1 month old today.
I have seen it in my dreams night and day. The only constant thing in life is that there's change. While I grow the garbage, I hope slips away. I was raised a straight boy, but I'm not today. I was raised a straight boy, but I'm not today.
He's adorable. You know, I think I have an aunt named Jesse. So what do you think? Will he be dating girls or boys?
Oh, we can't tell yet, of course. But whatever makes him happy.
That's right, dear. Whatever makes little Jesse happy.
The use of the other voices was interesting on that song. You didn't hear, well, you don't hear that done much during the song.
That's left over from years before, from Three Teens Go Four, the
right.
recordings and stuff like that.
Yeah, I see that now, yeah.
Yeah. Oh, a lot of people did that kind of stuff. That was nothing too original there. Those voices are mine. Those are me. And there's my neighbor, Sylvie, who did the girl's voice.
Please tell me about Slipping Quickly into Oblivion.
That's written for a man named Gregory Portley, who was my first lover when I was very young. I was 15. And he was the editor of the Fire Island newspaper, Fire Island in Ocean Beach. We kept in touch and stayed together. We weren't lovers, literally, like boyfriends, but we just stayed together for years and years and years. And he eventually became ill and died. And after he died, I received $20,000 in the mail as a surprise heritage. And it's with that money that I made that album.
Wow.
And so I dedicated the album to him, and the story is us meeting in Fire Island at Ocean Beach. Because I used to go to Fire Island when I was a child with my grandparents. And I didn't even know the gay area until much later, until I was 30 years old. And Gregory was a wonderful person who taught me a lot. And then also actually made it possible to make the album.
The first time I met Gregory, I had to be sure that he had seen me waving at the Ocean Beach ferry. My grandmother was leaving that day. There was no hiding desire. Summer had come to the island of fire, and Jaws was a big film that year. We all swam in silent fear. Spoke softly to me, easing me into myself, like the boat gently crossing the bay. There we made love the next night, as the stars flew quickly across the sky. These things I'd never seen. Greg explained everything. Us by staying in touch, we drifted apart without an awful lot to say, and without lies those years played. Moi je voulais apprendre le français, alors Paris je suis allé, c'est pendant cette année, saison. Greg, he passed on recently. The last time we met, it was Memorial Day. 31st floor balcony. We watched the fireworks display. I saw the death in his eyes, alongside the love he had never disguised. And like those exploding suns, Greg jumped quickly into oblivion.
I read that, let's see, this is late 90s. You and Chris Cochran and Dudley Sandler organized the New Tribe.
Yeah, Songs of the New Tribe. Gosh, you really have a... You've got your information. Yeah, that was fun. That was at PS122, and that was just, you know, it was just there were more and more people who were openly gay and writing material that was gay, and there was a guy named David Clement whose album I helped put out on my little label, and Dudley Saunders, who had a beautiful voice, and Chris, who was a great musician and still is, I'm sure. Just I don't know if he does it still, but there were a lot of people who performed. Toshi Reagan. She's still around?
Yes.
And who else? I can't name other people I don't remember, but there was about, I don't know, five or six different concert nights, and it was an attempt to just gather different people who were you know, a little bit like Out Music, but not as musician oriented, but just to get it out more on a more concert, you know, professional level.
Were you involved with Out Music as well?
With Out Music?
Yeah.
Sure, yeah. I went to Out Music, not as regularly as some others, but every now and then I would go. Yep. I was always embarrassed at Out Music. I don't know why. Not about myself or them, but I, for some reason, I only performed maybe like four or five times at Out Music. And every time I had a bad performance, I don't know why. I figured after a while, well, it was something psychological going on, and I should just stop.
Well, it's a very supportive group.
Yes, it always was. It's true, and I don't know why. And you know something? In general, performing was not something I liked doing. And I guess at Out Music, I felt maybe more at ease to feel as uncomfortable as I was with performing. I really don't know why. But it never worked for me. Out Music was a nice group of people, though. Very nice. Very supportive. There was a song circle. You mentioned it in your email. That was much more helpful to me than the actual Out Music nights. But the song circle I did with Grant King and Amy...
Fix.
Yeah. That was really nice. We were very... Because we were more focused, you know, and there was room for conversation, too, instead of just performing. But in a sense, it's not really, you know, it's not really, sometimes you analyze too much and you should just go up and do it. And that way Out Music was good. People took chances.
You're in Paris now. How did you get there?
I lived here, in 1990 for a year with different friends from New York. And at the end of that year, I met, Serge Lipsky, who helped me on the album too. And, I was already planning to go back to New York, but we stayed together, and we ended up staying together for 13 years. You know, after a period of time when I wanted to really leave New York, and his apartment was large enough for me to live in, I came to Paris to live here. That was 6 years ago. But it was something that I had planned to do more or less for a while.
Well, you were already a couple long before you left the
right.
United States.
That's right.
Are there any other aspects of your music career I should have asked about?
Well, other aspects, you know, what I think for a while there I was interested in being an independent, I was very inspired by Ani DiFranco when she came out and tried my hand at being an independent record company and realized that, you know, that takes a whole different set of muscles than writing songs and singing them. And I had my hands in that for a while, and I really didn't like it. And I was glad to leave the selling of music completely. And performing was never something I liked so much either. So really, I got a lot of pleasure out of singing and writing, but, you know, at home alone. And, that doesn't help you too much when you're trying to sell music. So, I don't know. There was times on stage where I had a great time, but usually when I was playing a character of someone else. But when you're playing yourself and, trying to, you know, sing intimate ballads about your inner feelings, it's not so easy to get across. And, I suppose if I had more of a love of the stage and performance, then I would have stuck with it more. But, you know, I'm happy not doing it, quite frankly.
KPFT is in pledge drive this week, so I had to trim this edition of Queer Music Heritage down a bit to allow more time for a little ever-important pitching. So if you enjoy this kind of programming, please consider calling in with a pledge. But my internet listeners can hear the complete original show, plus several additional minutes of the interviews, as I do not have the same time constraints when I upload shows to my website. And this is a good time to invite you to check out my site at www.queermusicheritage.com. If you visit it while you're listening, you can see the playlist and follow along while looking at photos of the artists and recordings. I've always considered our music history as a visual as well as an audio experience. Also, for more very queer programming, please listen to After Hours with Jimmy Carper, now in its new time slot, every Friday night, Saturday morning, from 1 to 4 a.m. on KPFT. It's queer radio with attitude.
There's knots in your stomach, tightness in my throat. Half the things we say these days get hurled back as a quote. We came together easily, but something has gone wrong. The air's gotten heavy, 'cause I'm leaving, but I'm a different kind of gone.
For the rest of the show, I'm very pleased to bring you an interview with Mary Gaucher. Now, she was raised in Tripadeau, Louisiana, and Gaucher is a very Louisiana name. It's spelled G-A-U-T-H-I-E-R, and her album covers are quick to give the pronunciation. She's released 4 albums since 1997 and has been charming the critics ever since she turned to music. And she took up music much later than most, at age 35. But the road to get there was a rough one, and you can hear the pain and heartache she waded through in her songs. A quick bio makes her sound like the subject for a Lifetime movie of the week. She grew up a wild child, raised by adoptive parents in Louisiana. She stole their car at age 15 and ran away from home. She spent her 18th birthday in jail, moved away again, and stayed with some drag queen friends for about a year, dealing with life with the help of booze and pills. Through all that, she studied philosophy at LSU, then attended the Cambridge School of Culinary Arts and founded Boston's first Cajun restaurant, still drinking all the way. She started the restaurant in 1990 and ran it for about 10 years, and during that time she sobered up and started writing songs, and then performing at open mics. And in 1997, she released her first album, Dixie Kitchen. Gradually, she wanted to write more than she wanted to cook, so she got her business partners to buy her out and used the money to make her second album, Drag Queens and Limousines, released in 1999. At the Gay and Lesbian American Music Awards, the GLAMAs, that album won for Best Country Recording. And that was when I first became aware of her music, and I've been a fan ever since. The song we're listening to in the background, A Different Kind of Gone, comes from that album. In 2002 came her third CD, Filth and Fire, and more acclaim, including it being named by the New York Times as one of the best of the year. And this spring came another album called Mercy Now, and I think she just gets better and better. We're going to start the interview talking about her songwriting, and then cover several older songs, and finally the new album. Let's start out with, how do you describe your musical style?
Oh, I don't. I let journalists do that. I just write songs and bring them to the producer in Austin, Texas, and he helps build them into what they sound like. What I am is a word person, and primarily and most importantly what I do is put words together with a melody. but my focus is the words and always has been. So I'm a Southerner born and raised in Baton Rouge, and so when I start to sing, it sounds country, although I'm not sure that I would describe it as country. You know, a lot of people have a different idea of what it is that I do. I really don't know how to tell people what to think about it. I just sort of do it, and then people think what they think. It's hard to describe what I do.
Well, the instrumentation is certainly mostly country.
Kinda. But if I had to stretch it, it would be also folk. Because of the word, the base of it is the words. So, there's not really a genre to put it in. Somewhere in there. It's between country and folk, I'm not sure what it is. American roots music. Or just plain old American music.
Tell us about the new CD.
Mercy Now came out February 15th, and it's on Lost Highway Records, which is my first major label record deal, and it's doing pretty good, and I'm real proud of it. I put my heart into it. I did the very best I could do. I hope people like it. I'm proud of it. I know beyond a doubt it's the best I can do right now, so I know I can live with it for the rest of my life, which I'll have to do, which is why they call it a record. It's permanent. So, I don't know what to tell you about it, except I did my best.
How is it different musically from your previous CDs?
I'm not sure if it is. There's a progression when you're a songwriter, and you develop your own style, and you move with the muse. You know, the muse, the source of all this creativity is really in charge, and you're just trying to keep up with her half the time. So I think it may be a little darker than some of the other records, which is a stretch since the other ones are pretty dark. And there's some spoken word pieces, which I hadn't done before. But I think it's recognizable as a Mary Gaucher record. I don't think it's a big, huge leap in another direction.
I think it's a touch more intimate.
Yeah, I'm singing softer, which lends itself towards that word intimate. And I think I'm digging a little deeper. It's a little more personal, I guess, which is also another weird thing to say since my other records are so personal already.
Do you ever regret putting so much of yourself into a song?
I wish I had more of myself to put into my song. No, absolutely not. I think that's what an artist's job is. And quite frankly, the most personal things about me or any artist are the most universal. You know, the universal part of us is the deepest part. You got to dig in there to get to it. You got to get past navel gazing into something that's deeper than that. And that's universality, and that's what I think an artist's job is, to find that and to deliver that. And that's what I try so hard to do. I wish there was more of it for me to access so I can give away more of it.
How do you think starting your music career at an older age than most has affected your writing?
I'm glad I did. I wrote my first song when I was 35. And I think I hope I'm mature. I try to be mature. I sometimes I'm more successful than others, but I do have a certain perspective. And I think that being a more mature songwriter gives me a broader palette. I have more to write about. I've lived more.
Has your relationship to any of your earlier songs changed since you recorded them? I mean, I've had artists tell me some songs have become more true to them, like they grew into them.
Yeah, you know, it's a strange thing. I think, you know, as human beings, we hopefully every year grow a little and change a little. And then a bunch of years go by, and if you look back on the you that existed 10 years ago, a lot of us will wonder, who the heck is that? Like, I don't even recognize that person anymore. That's not me. That's someone else. And so when you're a songwriter, you're documenting your life, and you're singing these songs over and over again. And as the years go by, you sing the same words, but they take a different meaning. Because the person singing them has changed. So I think over the years you do relate to your songs differently. I know that I do. Fortunately for me, they've held up enough for me to still continue to want to sing them and feel as though they ring true. but in different ways. It's an interesting relationship between a songwriter and a song.
I've heard it's not unusual for you to do 300 or 400 rewrites of a song.
Yeah, I'm a perfectionist, and I want to get it as strong as it can possibly be. And I'm trying to get down deeper and get down deeper and get down deeper into what I perceive as the truth, which doesn't mean necessarily that it actually happened, but that it gets it down to a spiritual truth. And I want the song to have a reason to exist. There has to be a reason. I mean, I'm not just writing pop songs. I'm trying to write songs that are there for a purpose. And the purpose is not entertainment so much as it is, what would the purpose be? I'm not sure. It's looking for the truth, I guess. And so that's a long journey, and it's a process of discovery. So I'll just keep writing until I know that I've done it, until I've nailed that particular song. And I'm not quick. When I live in Nashville, a lot of these guys here are so quick, and they're so good. And I'm just amazed by some of these minds here. But mine moves a lot slower, so I just have to work a lot harder.
Does the art get ahead of the craft, or vice versa?
Sometimes. Sometimes. I always like to look at it like the art is the part that the muse delivers, that it's outside of me. And the craft is the sweat I put into it. The craft is the perspiration part. And the two have got to work hand in hand, because the muse ain't going to give you the whole thing, not usually. You know, the inspiration part is a flash, and then you have to build it, which is the craft. And so you go from art to craft and art to craft and art to craft in the process of writing. And for me, it's a back and forth sort of relationship.
Do you enjoy it?
Oh, it's a love-hate.
How do gay issues figure into your writing?
You know, I approach the gay thing as just a matter of fact. So the gay issue to me is as much a matter of fact as my family issues or the issues I've had with addiction or the issues I've had with relationships. There's just a long litany of matter of facts that are there. But it's not a special category for me, so I just throw that in with everything else.
That's what I would say. You know, it's part of the fabric.
Yeah, it's part of the fabric. I'm unapologetic, but I don't make a big deal about it. So, and the reason is it's just one of those things. It's not more important than the other things I just mentioned, or less important. So when I'm writing, I had this song that was a title track of my second CD called Drag Queens and Limousines. And, you know, it's a song about a gay kid growing up. But I don't have to say this is a song about a gay kid growing up. It's obvious. But I wanted it to read in a way that other people who have struggles growing up can relate to it. And interestingly, there's a huge amount of straight people, and cowboys in particular, believe it or not, that relate to that. I love it that cowboys, straight cowboys, can relate to a song called Drag Queens in Limousines and want to feel like, and do feel like, they're a part of that.
That's amazing.
I think it's just exactly what an artist should do. And I'm so proud and thrilled that I've been blessed to be able to do that. Because the truth of the matter is that me being gay, that doesn't make me any different than a lonely cowboy, you know, who's had trouble with women. I'm like a 42-year-old woman who's had more than her share of trouble with women. Who can relate to that? Well, maybe a 42-year-old cowboy who's had more than his share of trouble with women. And we're experiencing a lot of the same things, and we relate to each other. And the gay thing doesn't need to be a block or a wall or a way of making distinctions. It just is. It doesn't make me different. I don't think it makes me different. It's just another issue, you know. And because I don't think it makes me different, they don't see me or the characters as different, and so we're kind of in it together. And I know this sounds like an ideal thing, but it really does seem to be happening.
I hated high school,
I prayed it would end. The jocks and their girls, it was their world. I didn't fit in. Mama said, baby, it's the best school money can buy. Be strong, hold your head up. Come on, Mary, try. I stole Mama's car on a Sunday. I left home for good. Moved in with some friends in the city, in a bad neighborhood. Charles was a dancer. He loved the ballet. And Kimmy sold pot and red Carol.
There's a lot of her story in that song, Drag Queens and Limousines, the title track from her 1999 album. Mary, of what song that you've written are you the most proud?
Hard to say. I do love Drag Queens and Limousines because it does that bridge building thing that I really want to do. It builds bridges from things that people think make us different and show how they don't make us different at all, that we're all the same. We're all made from the same blood and guts. The same emotional material goes into all of us.
Okay, then what song gets the most audience reaction?
I think the song that people are drawn to so far that I've written is called I Drink, which is a song in first person being sung by a character who's an alcoholic. And it starts out as kind of a sparse ballad, and people think it's funny, and then as it goes on, people realize, oh man, this isn't funny at all. This character's in tough shape. Because it's so sparse, I think people are taken aback by it, and then they can really hear it. It's one of those songs where I removed every single word except the words that I couldn't take out. There's just not that many words in that song, and it hits them between the eyes. So that's the one that people react to the strongest, I think.
I heard an interview where you said that when you first started singing, people laughed, and you were kind of taken aback by that.
Yeah, because I didn't think it was funny when I wrote it. You know, I don't think alcoholism is funny. But I think people don't realize it's about alcoholism until I get deeper into it. So they think it's a funny drunk song, you know, of which there's a million and one of those. They're along for the fun drinking, ha ha, ain't this great sort of thing, and then they realize, oh boy, this ain't great. And so, at first I didn't realize it was going to strike people as funny. And now I do know that that's what's going to happen, and it happens every time I play it. It's a very strange reaction, but I've come to understand where people are coming from with their laughter.
And there's an element of, I guess, catchiness about that song.
Yeah, there is. Kids like it, you know. I think it's the minimalism.
How would you compare the two recordings of the song, I Drink?
Well, I wouldn't actually have recorded it again, but the record label wanted me to. And they wanted me to because they felt as though that was a very strong song and they wanted people to hear it. And the previous recording was on a record that I own and never got very much distribution. And so they wanted me to cut it again on this major label release so that more people could hear it. And how could I argue with that?
No.
You know, I think it was probably a good idea, although I wouldn't have come up with it because I don't like to revisit songs. I like to move forward. But I do think it was a good idea. So I think on the new version, I'm probably singing a little better. Although the original version to me is always going to be the one that I resonate with because it was so raw at that time. I like the rawness of it.
Think it was more mournful?
Yeah, and I think that the guy singing behind me in the backup vocal was there was a lot of reasons I picked him to sing. And he resonated with me so strongly. You know, he was singing his heart out. And in a lot of ways that song was about him, and he knew it. And so that just kills me. And it strikes me. And I get emotional reaction when I hear it because I know the story behind it.
He'd get home at 5:30, fix his drink, sit down in his chair, pick a fight with mama, complain about us kids getting in his hair. At night he'd sit alone and smoke. I'd see his frown behind his lighter's flame. Now that same frown's in my mirror. I got my daddy's blood inside my veins. Fish swim, birds fly, daddy's yell, mama's cry. Old men sit and think. I drink.
I Drink first appeared on the album Drag Queens and Limousines, and you just heard part of the re-recorded version from her new album. From your first album, please tell me about Goddamn HIV.
I wrote that song. It's one of the first songs I've written. It's about a friend of mine. It's sort of a composite about several friends of mine who died of AIDS. One of my best buddies in Baton Rouge got sick. He's the first person that we all knew who had the virus. And it was 84, 85, something like that. And he's in there trying to remember what he went through. I wrote that. And then there were other friends who were sick but who hadn't died yet. And they're in there. And I tried to write it. I tried to think, how would, you know, it was before the movie Philadelphia came out, but I was still thinking, how would Bruce Springsteen do this? And how would Woody Guthrie do this? How would they write this song? And that's who I was trying to channel when I wrote that. And so my thoughts were to write it in first person, like I'm the guy, and just have him walking on the train tracks at the end of the song into the darkness.
It's probably the best song from your first album.
I think it is the best song from my first album.
My name is Michael Joe Alexandre. I've been a queer since the day I was born. My family, they don't say much to me. My heart knows their silence has scorn. And my friends have been dying. All my best friends are dead. I walk around these days with their picture in my head. Spend my time thinking about some things they said. And I don't know what's happening to me. Goddamn HIV.
Please tell me about Evangeline.
That is I call that one of my Baton Rouge songs. That's a story of me dating a stripper, sort of falling in love with a no-win situation, of which I have a long history of doing. The loneliness of that, just the absolute loneliness of being like a young gay kid who doesn't realize it's not a great idea to do that. That's going to cause a whole lot of pain.
I read where you said you were trying to save her, and really you needed saving.
Yeah. Isn't it funny though, when you need saving, you don't know it sometimes, and you think you're the savior. I was guilty of that for a long time.
She said, "You are not my lover, so don't look in me that way. Just 'cause I let you touch me don't mean I'll let you stay. Said lovers try to change me, the minute I care, but baby, when I'm dancing, I dance on air, I dance on air. God's alive, babe. Yes, he comes through.
For your Filth and Fire album, you wrote the song Sugar Cane with another artist I respect very much, Katie Curtis. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, Katie's my good buddy in Boston, and when I lived over there, she said, let's try to write a song together. So I went over to her house, and we wrote that song. It's about the sugar cane fields in Louisiana. The way that they burn the sugar cane, it creates a giant toxic mess down there. And I thought, let's see if we can try to put this story together. And she helped me out a lot with that. And I think it was a successful co-write. I don't co-write a lot. Although I live in Nashville, I'm not a great co-writer because, like we said earlier, I'm such a perfectionist. I drive people crazy. You know, people want the song to be done, and I'm thinking we're like 20% there. So I drive people nuts. I'm not people's first choice as a co-writer.
That's a nice Neil Young opening on that song.
Isn't it Neil Youngish? I think it is Neil Youngish. I definitely am a huge Neil Young fan and always have been. And I love the way he plays the harmonica, and I just sort of steal his style there. Hold those long notes, and for some reason, those particular chords just sound like Neil Young. You go E minor A, E minor A, and the whole world thinks it's Neil Young. He owns those chords. You know, there's only so many to work with, but he owns those two, that's for sure.
He could be on your duets album.
Wouldn't that be nice? You got his number?
She don't give a damn what those people say. Cane smoke can't be good for you day after day. Every year at harvest time, when the black smoke filled the sky, she'd pick me up and take me home
Now we're up to the new album, Mercy Now. Please tell us about Empty Spaces.
A buddy of mine here in Nashville came over with that song, and there were some real big problems with it he couldn't solve. And I kept his melody, and I put some lines in there that fixed it. I loved it when he brought it over. I thought, oh man, this could make a biker cry. There's stuff in here that's just so strong. I can see a guy named Grizzly wiping tears off his face.
Silly me, what was I thinking? I could have sworn you still loved me, but I'm a fool born to chase rainbows. I can never hold you to what you said with your eyes, you and me. Hey, weren't we something? We're holding hands in that picture hanging in the hall. Well, I took it down after you left. Now there's an empty spaces, ain't nothing new. Rainbows ain't something that you hold on to. They move out as the storm moves through. And empty spaces ain't nothing new. There's a big storm coming, of this I've no doubt. That storm's gonna blow your little world inside out. When the wild winds let up, when the violence wanes, you'll think of me then, when you're watching it rain. It ain't the wind, it's the rain.
How about It Ain't the Wind, It's the Rain?
That song's about anger. That's an angry little song. That's telling my ex, you know, you may be sitting in high cotton right now, but one day it's going to start raining, and it's going to rain and rain and rain. And, you know, God help you then.
I just love the way you talk about your writing.
Oh, thank you. Writing is the one relationship I've managed to stay in.
That's it, kept true to you.
Yeah, you know, the mistress is my one true love, I guess. And if she lets me down, I don't know where I'll go or what I'll do.
Dark water spill over the levee and rush down the hill. They'll carry me with them. I won't have to explain. There'll be no rain.
Hey, y'all. This is Queer Music Heritage you're listening to, and I'm Mary Gaucher.
Now, I've got one more song to share with you, but before I get to it, I want to thank you all for listening, and to thank Jesse Holtberg and Mary Gaucher for the wonderful interviews. And as always, if you have questions or comments about any of the music I featured, please write me at qmheritage@aol.com, and I wish you would. My website, of course, is at www.queermusicheritage.com. This is J.D. Doyle for Queer Voices on KPFT in Houston. I saved the title track for last. Tell me about the song, Mercy Now.
I think that's one of those songs that was delivered to me. I think that was handed to me. I'm not sure how I ended up being the lucky one to get that song, but it's an amazing journey. That song starts out very personal about my own father, who's got Alzheimer's and is getting sicker by the day, about my own brother, who has his own struggles. And it's very personal, specific to my family. And then somehow the camera lens, pulls back. And then I'm talking about the church, and I'm talking about America. And then the camera lens pulls back again, and I'm talking about the entire human race. And then in the end, somehow the lens goes into a completely different frame, and it's all of us. It's all of us. And it's something that was incredibly exciting to write, because I didn't know what I was doing, and then in the end it looked like I knew what I was doing. It was a real mysterious thing that happened, and I've never written anything like that before, and it felt like a discovery, like I was panning for gold, and I pulled the pan up, and I had a pan full of gold.
So you didn't really conceive the progression at the
beginning? No, it happened on its own.
Wow.
No, there was no forethought in that. I'm not that smart. I'm creating out of nothing. I don't have that ability to see the end. I'm panning, and then it looks like it's coming into focus, and as it started to come into focus, I started to get really excited because I saw that it was making a lot of sense. But no, I didn't know where it was going or what it was trying to say.
I think years from now, people will say, "Mercy Now, that was one of Mary's masterpieces."
Well, thank you for saying that. I appreciate that. Gosh, I hope you're right. I know I'm real proud of it, and I know I can't explain how it happened, that it just happened.
My father could use a little mercy now. The fruits of his labor falling right slowly on the ground. His work is almost over. It won't be long. He won't be around. I love my father. He could use some mercy now. My brother could use a little mercy now. He's a stranger to freedom. He's shackled to his fear and his doubt. The pain that he lives in, it's almost more than living will allow. I love my brother. He could use some mercy now. My church and my country could use a little mercy now. As they sank into a poison pit, it's gonna take forever to climb out. They carry the weight of the faithful who follow them down. I love my church and country. They could use some mercy now. Every living thing could use a little mercy now. Only the hand of grace can end the race towards another mushroom cloud. People in power, they'll do anything to keep their crown. I love life and life itself. Could you some mercy? Every single one of us could use some mercy.